For Jane Brody, good health is a lifelong affair, and the New York Times personal health columnist follows her own advice, enjoying a healthy diet and engaging in daily physical activity. Healthy living is the topic when Jane Brody speaks this coming Monday evening at the annual symposium of the University of Illinois Center for Nutrition, Learning, and Memory. But today, she's our guest on Focus, and we'll hear her advice on personal health, including the difficult but vital topic of end-of-life health care. Then, in the second half of our show, we'll turn our attention to this weekend's Illinois Marathon in Champaign-Urbana. Pioneer women's marathon runner Catherine Switzer is a guest at the marathon, and she'll talk about her love of marathons, her role in opening up marathons to women, and the impact of the Boston Marathon bombing on the sport. I'm Jim Meadows. That's all coming up on Focus on WILL after the news. Hi, I'm Jim Meadows, and welcome to Focus. And coming up later this hour, we'll be talking with Catherine Switzer about this weekend's Illinois Marathon in Champaign-Urbana and Catherine's role in opening marathons to women. But my guest for the next 20 minutes or so has been called the High Priestess of Health by Time magazine. Jane Brody studied to be a biochemist, went into the journalism instead, and since the 1970s, she's been writing on personal health for the New York Times and other newspapers through syndication. Her many books include Jane Brody's nutrition book, Jane Brody's Good Food Gourmet, and Jane Brody's Guide to the Great Beyond. More about that later, but Jane Brody, welcome to Focus.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And in the time we have with you, as I cautioned, just about 20 minutes, if you have a question for Jane Brody, the number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Jane, I was wondering, when you're covering a field like health, where there's so much research and so much argument and changes of judgment over the years, what sort of changes have you seen since you started covering that beat?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because what happened is that I started out, just like every other science writer started out, writing about the miracles of modern medicine, you know, how we patched people up after they got sick. And what I have seen and what I have done with my own career is emphasize prevention. Let's not wait until the horse is out of the barn. Let's lock the door while the horse is still inside and get people healthier. So the emphasis now in the field is keeping people well and keeping people's minds and bodies as functional as possible, as the miracles of modern medicine are keeping them alive for 9-10 decades.
Now, you're talking Monday evening at the University of Illinois here in Urbana. Is that the emphasis in your talk?
The emphasis in my talk will be on living a healthy life and how it is not so difficult as people seem to think it is. Cooking is not such a challenge. You don't have to cook every day to eat healthy food, but you have to know how to make good choices, and you have to know how to plan your life accordingly. People say, oh, I don't have time to exercise. Well, you have time to brush your teeth. You have time to sleep. You have time to watch a television program. Exercise is part of daily life, and we have programmed it out of our daily lives through all the mechanical gadgets that we all have and love. And I'm not saying that we have to go back to washing our laundry on a scrub board, but if you don't want to do that, you have to do something else.
And, you know, I was thinking of that as, you know, I was looking at your nutrition book, and maybe you've had updated editions since then, but the one that I saw was the first edition, and you write at the very beginning, Americans are people ignorant of good nutrition, that more than half the foods we eat are processed and packaged, that we eat too much fat, too much sugar, too many calories, even too much protein. And that was 32 years ago, but it sounds like it could have been written yesterday.
Unfortunately, that's true. Unfortunately, we have not made, we know what we're supposed to do, but we are not doing it. And the growth of processed food industry has been enormous, and people just don't make their own food anymore, and they're paying a health price for that. And they don't realize it until it's too late. And when it's too late, you know, you say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, I should have done better, and now I have this problem. Well, we really don't have to have all of these problems, and we have to start thinking more carefully about the kinds of things we put in our bodies. You know, treat your body as a temple, not as a garbage pail.
Has it been a challenge for you in just living up to your own advice over the years?
Well, you know, I'm no paragon of virtue. I grew up with a sweet tooth. I've never lost it. I need to have something sweet after every meal, even breakfast. But I don't have to have a lot of it. I don't have to have, you know, a 12-ounce serving of frozen yogurt. I can do with a quarter of a cup. Not that I have that after breakfast, but it's my bedtime snack, and I just love it. But I choose it wisely. I have low-fat ice cream, no more than 150 calories in a quarter of a cup, and it's balanced out over the course of the rest of my life. It's not something that I added on, because if you add on 150 calories a day without compensating for them somehow in the form of activity or not eating something else that's caloric, you will, by the end of the year, put on about 10 pounds.
You know, I was thinking, and you were talking just a moment ago about processed foods,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things I've noticed about processed foods, even about things that I don't think as being particularly dangerous or hazardous, is that you'll find sugar in almost everything. And I've gotten to the point now that, you know, unless I don't know, are these foods all supposed to have sugar, or is it something of a bonus once we get to processed foods?
Well, it's an interesting thing, but, you know, people have focused on sugar now. That's the latest thing people are focusing on. But it's not the teaspoon of sugar that goes into tomato sauce that's the issue. It's not even the teaspoon of sugar that's in a tablespoon of ketchup that's the issue. It's the many, many teaspoons of sugar that go into our soft drinks and sweetened fruit juices, which now they call them fruit juices, but if you look at the label, the first ingredient is sugar. So you have to be really careful about what we're worried about. We're worrying about some of the wrong things. We shouldn't be worried about the minor ingredients. We're worrying about the major ingredients. And if you want to worry about a minor ingredient, the minor ingredient to start worrying about is salt, not sugar.
And it's just that there's too much of that?
Way too much of that in processed foods. And, you know, the nutrition label on these packages is so small that most people just ignore it, or they can't see it when they're in the marketplace. And I suggest that people take a magnifying glass with them when they shop and just take a look at what it is you're buying. You know, what it says on the label may have very little to do with what you're really putting in your mouth and into your body. And so it's really important. Salt is a problem in this country because it's a combination problem. We have a problem with calories. People are fatter than they ever were in the history of our country. And as a result of that overweight, they're much more susceptible, not just to type 2 diabetes, but to hypertension, high blood pressure, and high blood pressure in turn causes heart disease and stroke and kidney failure. So the salt adds to that problem, and there's so much salt in processed foods, it's really astonishing. And if you just, when you go to shop, just take a look at, compare one brand with another and see which one is the lower in sodium. Sodium is ingredient in salt that is problematic and that raises blood pressure. So you just make your choices based on differences that you find in the marketplace. And wherever possible, cook your own food where you can put on as much salt as tastes good, but not so much that's going to kill you.
What do you think of efforts such as in New York City with Mayor Bloomberg's recent efforts to try to control the sales of, you know, large portion soft, sugary soft drinks?
I wish it had happened. I wish it will happen for the simple reason that we have to change the culture. If we don't change the culture, if we don't get away from the idea that a 32-ounce sugar-laden drink that has no nutrients except sugar is okay, we're not going to make significant progress in controlling this problem. People have to become aware. And we did this with cigarettes, we had to, and educating people is just simply not enough. We had to legislate. When you simply said you cannot smoke here, there, and everywhere else, people really started thinking, well, gee, maybe this is not such a great idea. And smokers became pariahs. If you start looking askance at somebody with this monster-sized soft drink filled with sugar, there's nothing but sugar and water and food coloring in those drinks. It's just poison, really. It's poison for the body. And I think we should have some kind of legislation for the simple reason that it raises people's consciousness.
Do you think low-calorie sweeteners are a benign substitute for sugar, or do they have their own problems?
Well, you know, people have been screaming and carrying on about these non-caloric sweeteners for decades, and the truth of the matter is nothing has come of it. Nothing terrible has happened as a result of people drinking aspartame, for example. Yeah, there are always a few people sensitive to a particular substance, just the way there are people who can't eat peanuts. But for the average person, I have not seen any untoward effects of these artificial sweeteners. And therefore, if you really want your soft drinks, that's what you should have. And that's what I have in my house. I don't have them every day, but when I want one, it's there and it doesn't have any calories.
We were talking about exercise a few minutes before. I was wondering what people should think of as they just adjust their what they're capable of doing as they get older. What is meaningful exercise when
you know? When, it's fascinating because I was just reading an article that showed that just 45 minutes a day of walking, mostly walking, three times a week. Just 45 minutes, three times a week, after a year, the volume of people's brains actually increased and they had better memories. That means that more brain cells were created and the connections between brain cells and one part of the brain to the other were improved and people's blood supply to their brain increased so that you end up with a better cognitive function as you age. Now, there are all sorts of things. I work out at the Y every day. I swim. I do a morning walk with my friends. We are all in our 70s, so don't tell me you can't do it because you're an old person. I mean, I see people out there who are in their 80s doing the same thing. I plan to continue to do this into my 80s as soon as, if life lets me live that long. And then I go swim. I swim laps in a Y pool, and who follows my swim? My lap swim time. Ladies in their 80s and 90s who come to do water aerobics. So there's all sorts of possibilities. There's all sorts of options out there that are perfectly safe for people with arthritis, people with, one of the ladies who comes in for water aerobics was crippled many, many, many years ago by a skiing accident, and she uses a walker. And she has a brace on her leg, and yet she comes there religiously, and she has to travel to get there by public transportation, and yet she's a religious user of the water aerobics class. And she looks terrific, and she feels terrific because she does this.
Jane, of all the books I see that you've put out, the one that really got my attention, because I just can't think of anything else I've seen like it, is Your Guide to the Great Beyond, a practical primer to help you and your loved ones prepare medically, legally, and emotionally for the end of life. You put that out about 4 years ago, and I'm just wondering what sort of feedback you've gotten from that book since then.
You know, it's fascinating. The publisher did almost nothing to publicize this book, which is absolutely criminal, because everyone who has used it and read it has said it has been so incredibly helpful to them when they are dealing with these kinds of issues in their own families, or they have already been through it, and they've said, I wish I had this when my mother was dying, because it's so helpful to know just how to deal with the medical profession, how to deal with the issues that involve your loved person who is ill, and how to make sensible choices, how to prepare your own family for what is inevitable. We don't, no matter how healthfully you live, no matter how much well you eat, no matter how much you exercise, no matter how effective you are at managing stress, we all come to the same end. There is no cure for mortality. And we have to recognize that this is something, this is part of the life cycle, just like birth and living. Death is part of the life cycle, and we really need to be prepared for it to be less painful for not just the person who's dying, but for all the people that they leave behind.
How, as a reporter, how challenging was it gathering up the material for this book? Was it hard to find, hard to get just the best answers for things?
You know, interestingly, it wasn't as difficult as I had imagined it would be. There are a lot of doctors who are thinking sensibly now about these issues. Not enough, of course. And one of the chapters in that book was what to do when your doctor is not on your side. How to handle the doctor who disappears when a person is near the end. You know, when the treatment that the doctor has to offer no longer works. They shy away from the patient, and the patient feels deserted, and the family is bereft. This kind of thing. How you can cope with that, and how you can get the doctor to come around and be on your side, and work with you when you're dealing with end of life issues.
Jane Brody is personal health columnist for the New York Times and other newspapers, and she's speaking Monday evening at 6 p.m. at the University of Illinois Beckman Institute Auditorium. The theme of her talk, Eat Well, Move Well, and Enjoy the Good Life. It's a free talk open to the public Monday evening at 6. And Jane Brody, thank you very much for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
It's time for a short break, and we'll be back with marathon pioneer Catherine Switzer. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WILL. The 5th Annual Illinois Marathon begins its activities today, with the full marathon and most of the other races taking place tomorrow morning on the streets of Champaign-Urbana. The 5-kilometer race is tonight. Catherine Switzer is speaking at the marathon's sold-out Health and Fitness Expo this afternoon. Catherine Switzer helped open up marathons to women at every level, from local events to the Olympics, an achievement fueled by her own deep love of the sport. My interview with Catherine Switzer was recorded earlier, so we're unable to take phone calls. Catherine Switzer, you have, of course, an important place in history with the Boston Marathon, but you were in Boston for the marathon last week during a very sad day for that event. You were not running in this marathon this year.
That's right, Jim. Thank you for asking, and I'm actually very glad to be talking to you because it was a very traumatic day and experience. I have run the Boston Marathon 8 times, but stopped doing it when I had an opportunity to get into sports organization and also broadcasting. And on Monday was my 36th consecutive broadcast for television of the Boston Marathon. And so I went out as usual to my finish line position. We broadcast from the photo bridge right over the finish for all of the action for 5 hours. And so lucky for me, we had finished the show, and I had said goodbye to my colleagues and said that I'd see them back in the press room only 20 minutes before the bomb went off. So I wasn't there, thank God, for the explosion. But I certainly watched the chaos and heard it from my hotel room.
And a crime like this can just change things in a moment. While you were commentating, the marathon was going on, people were running. I'm sure it was an exciting and even happy event up until that moment.
You know, the marathon is uniquely happy and joyful. It is probably the only sport in the world where people don't boo each other. And a wonderful line that has been quoted quite a lot this week from a book that my husband Roger Robinson and I wrote called 26.2 Marathon Stories is, if you're losing faith in human nature, go out and watch a marathon. Because we see all elements of human emotion and endeavor and trying and joy and empowerment and freedom and even fearlessness. And so all of that occurs on the day of the marathon. And it changes the streets of our cities in such a wonderful, profound way. And, of course, all of that was happening Totally, on Monday, as well as other things. You know, ironically, for this particular Monday, this race at Boston this year, we observed 26 seconds of silence right before the start and during our broadcast as well, to honor and pay tribute to the poor school, little school children and their teachers who were gunned down in Newtown. And the race was held as, in a way, a tribute to them. People ran in memory of them. The gun that starts the race at the start was replaced, I hope, forever, for the first time in 117 years by an air horn. And so, yes, the marathon represents many, many things, but across the board, a happy and positive experience. So the bombing, of course, was just devastating for all of us.
How does this change your feelings or our people's feelings about the marathon experience? Do you think this is a dent, just knowing that at future marathons, and I know even at the Illinois Marathon that you'll be visiting, that you're at this weekend, which is, you know, not a, considered a big target, there will be extra security safeguards in place. Does this change anything?
Yes, definitely it changes something. First of all, it changes nothing in the minds of runners except to make them absolutely more determined and defiant, because running gives us a sense of freedom and fearlessness, and we will not have that taken away from us. And, in fact, if the Boston Marathon were to be held tomorrow, and certainly when it's held next year, a million people will want to run it. Everybody will want to be there. I suspect tomorrow at the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon, I suspect that people will be very emotional and very strong, and they will be outspoken about Boston. I suspect there will be more crowds than ever, because they also want to endorse and help this event in a big way, and they support the freedom of movement and joy. Certainly, last week at the London Marathon, the crowds were thicker than ever, by all reports, and they were waving Boston flags and signs and the stars and stripes and wearing black ribbons pinned to their singlets in tribute to Boston. But from the point of view of a race director, and I'm thinking especially of my friend Jan Seeley, who is an owner and race director of this race tomorrow, it's a heck of a job, because now they have to try to make secure 26.2 miles, which is virtually impossible. But certainly the start and the finish areas will be, there'll be extra security there. And it's heartbreaking, really, for a race director, because the costs of staging a marathon are enormous anyway, and the costs in terms of human resources and manpower and time and volunteerism is enormous, and this is and it's going to stretch municipalities' security systems a lot. You know, cities like New York and London are pretty much ready to handle a security system. London, of course, being the masters of it, with handling the Olympics so brilliantly last year without a single incident, which is really quite amazing. And New York, you know, having a total button down with the marathon after 9/11. Also, I was on the bridge doing the broadcast of the New York City Marathon right after 9/11, and that was about the only time I've ever been frightened, because, you know, I just thought that this is such an amazing photo op for a terrorist, and I just didn't really want to be there. But you have to go on. You have to do your job. You have to make it happen. But at any rate, yes, the problem is going to be in security with the race organization people themselves.
I'm thinking the concerns about safety and the I think the emotional power that people bring to it. You talked about the crowds that came to the London Marathon after the Boston Marathon bombing. It says something about the hold that marathons have on people compared to other athletic events, compared to, say, other shorter foot races. It's not like a track meet. It's something that takes up a whole city.
Yes, Jim, I'm glad you brought that up, because the act of marathon running is quite transformational. I mean, that sounds kind of woo-woo-woo out there, but the fact is that 26 miles is a long way, and you can't do it without training. And so that means people have to be dedicated and organized and really want to do it. Having said that, if you feel that way, almost anybody can, which is the miracle of it. And so when you watch these people running of all shapes, sizes, ages, abilities, and even handicaps, you know, it is heartlifting. And everybody applauds your fellow human for really trying and having the spirit and determination. And that's what it's about. I suspect that there are going to be an awful lot of people out in the streets cheering and being in support. I often say that the marathon transforms our major cities. It's where else are we going to see, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people on the move, and it's not an army, you know? It's a wonderful sight.
I'm thinking, you know, this sort of attraction that a marathon can have must have been part of the thing that pulled you to compete in the Boston Marathon in 1967, even though you were not officially supposed to be there.
Well, that is a real reason, Jim. That's true. You got to understand that where I first really got involved with the marathon was because my coach, who was actually a mailman at Syracuse University, he had run 15 Boston Marathons. And here was a guy, I mean, Syracuse, New York is worse than Champaign-Urbana by a million miles in terms of bad weather, believe me. I mean, we get more snow in Syracuse than you do in Anchorage. And here was a mailman who trudged through the snow every day to deliver the mail and all this slush and sleet, and then would go out and train in the dark and the cold every afternoon and evening because the Boston Marathon was once a year and he was going to run it, and that was the day he felt like a hero. And so there is, of course, with the history of the marathon, the whole element of heroism of the messenger running with the victory over the Persians, you know, in Greece in 490 BC. And so I had heard all these stories, and I was fascinated and caught up in them. And so when I told my coach that I wanted to run the marathon too, he sort of looked at me sideways and said, "Well, yeah, I can understand, but a woman can't do it." And I said, "What do you mean a woman can't do it?" He said, "Well, physiologically, it's impossible. You know, women are too weak and too fragile." And I really got mad and said that I knew I could do it. I came from great Illinois pioneering stock. I mean, we were homesteaders out in Illinois. And so we argued, and he finally said, if you show me in practice that you can do the distance, I'll be the first person to take you to Boston." So it became a contest of me proving to my coach that I could do it. And when we did do it, he was so proud of me that he helped me register for the race. And then there was a series of coincidences that led to me getting a number, mostly that I signed the application with my initials. They thought I was a man. The morning of the race, when we picked up our numbers, it was snowing and sleeting, and I had on a heavy warm-up suit and looked kind of like, from a distance, one of the guys, although all the guys knew I was a woman. And I began the race of my dreams. You know, here was I was at Boston at last, 1967, a 20-year-old co-ed from Syracuse University.
You know, I'm trying to piece this together and looking from 2013. It seems to be, it's not that so much that the Boston Marathon was a men-only event so much as no one had any conception that women could run marathons.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Several women had run marathons, I think about six up to that point, but none officially. And the one who ran in Boston the year before I did ran well, but she jumped out of the bushes and was kind of, you know, she was applauded, but wasn't taken too seriously. What happened with me is the officials saw that I was a woman in the race wearing numbers, and one, the co-race director, became furious and enraged, really, that a woman would violate his race. Now, rules had not been written, as you said, Jim. Rules had not been written anywhere that a woman was forbidden to run or that it was a men's only race. There was nothing about gender on the application blank or in the rule books. So it was just assumed that everybody knew it was a men's only race and women shouldn't and couldn't do it. So my coach said, "See, it's not against the rules. You can do it." And we signed up, and there we go.
And you put your initial in, were you intending deliberately to be a little vague, not to give any clues?
No, I was studying journalism at Syracuse, and I admired really the writers I loved, especially were E.E. Cummings and T.S. Eliot and J.D. Salinger. And I thought K.D. Switzer was cool, so I started signing my name that way, but also because my dad misspelled the Catherine on my birth certificate, and so I grew up with my name being constantly misspelled. And at about age 12, I had started signing my name with my initials. So it was just, you know, the way I signed my name. I wrote K.V. Switzer down, and the guys accepting the applications obviously thought it was from a man. I did not go to the starting line of Boston, you know, pounding on my chest saying, "Hey, guys, I'm here. I'm a woman," because all the men knew. They all say, "Hey, then that's great that a girl is here. I hope you do well." The story continues, of course, I'm sure, as you know, where at about 2 miles into the race, the press truck went by, and the race director was so infuriated, he leaped from the press truck, attacked me, and tried to pull my bib numbers off of me, screaming at me to get the hell out of his race and give me those numbers. My coach tried to get him away from me, but my burly boyfriend came to the rescue, threw a cross body block into the official, sent him flying through the air, and my coach just said, "Run like hell." Down the street we went. So it's funny in the retelling, but it was a very bad incident at the time, you know, because I was really embarrassed and terrified. But I don't think a day passes now, all these years later, that I don't thank this official for attacking me, because what he really did was inspire me.
You know, how was your time that day, by
well,
the way?
Well, I was 4 hours and 20 minutes, which isn't bad for a gorilla jumping on your back. But I had gotten over my anger by the time I finished the race, but I became very, very determined. And my primary determination was to become a better athlete, and I did. I won the New York City Marathon, and I ran a time of 2:51 eventually, which was world class at the time, but more determined to create opportunities in the sport for other women, because I knew that women would run if they only had a welcoming opportunity, and I was going to do that. And I did. It became my career.
The Boston Marathon and other marathons as well eventually started admitting women, and they're obviously a huge part of the competitive field and just the field in general there. But you've also been active in setting up women-only marathons.
Yes. I knew that the IOC wasn't going to take women's performances seriously in a mixed competition. So once we got official in Boston and we got credibility as runners, that was in 1972, I began working on women's-only races, which seems quite at odds with me integrating the Boston Marathon. But the point was, is I knew the International Olympic Committee wasn't going to take women's performances seriously in a mixed competition, because the Olympics had them separate.
And just like a track meet, we're used to seeing a track meet where there are men's and there's women's competition.
Exactly, but because the IOC would quickly say, well, women didn't really run that 26 miles; they were helped by men. See, I mean, that was the thinking in those days.
Okay.
So when I could create women's-only long-distance events and marathons in particular, and do them, create them well, you know, with world-class standards and sponsorship, then they would have to be convinced of women's worthiness. And indeed, in one race in particular, I created the Avon International Marathon, sponsored by Avon Cosmetics, in downtown London in 1980. And that was the first sports event ever that closed the downtown streets of London. And it became the precursor for what is now the London Marathon. And at that race, we had 27 countries and 5 continents represented, so that exceeded the International Olympic requirement for Olympic inclusion. So that, along with a lot of lobbying, a lot of medical evidence to prove that women were not going to turn into masculine behemoths and never have children, which is what they said would happen, we got the women's marathon into the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. And that race was a transformational event globally, because everybody around the world knows how far 26 miles or 42 kilometers is. They know it's far, and if women can do it and they look fine and they're competitive, what's the problem? Women can do anything.
It's interesting to think that the London Marathon started as a women's marathon.
Isn't it amazing? I must tell you, the former race director of the London Marathon never really wanted to admit that, but that was the precursor. I mean, it was sort of the canary in the coal mine, because we worked with Scotland Yard, we worked with the leader of the Greater London Council, we worked with different sports federations, and once we proved it could happen, they had always wanted, ever since they saw the New York City Marathon, to have a big city marathon. So we were sort of the test run. And it, of course, played into our hands, the women's hands, beautifully, because it was a really huge global setting. And we attracted, I think at least five major countries' television networks to cover it.
I'm wondering about the marathon experience, and that is being a runner in a marathon. There's something about it which seems so much of a communal event, but there's also something about running that's very solitary. Certainly practicing for a marathon must be pretty solitary.
Yes, but don't feel sorry for us. We're lost in our thoughts. Everybody says, oh, the loneliness of the long-distance runner, and you must be so lonely out there. Well, many runners have a buddy, and that makes time go quickly. I'm one of those runners who actually likes to even do 4 and 5 hour runs alone, because sometimes it's my only alone time. It's my best thinking time. It's creative. I mean, you know, you get very creative when you get all those endorphins and bouncing around your system and the oxygen flowing over your brain. But the nice thing is that, yes, you can come together in a marathon with 30,000 other somewhat like-minded people. You're still having to cover the distance by yourself, but you're around a very sympathetic company. Sometimes you make your best friends among people you've never even met before.
So when you're running in a marathon, are you still alone with your thoughts, or is it now you're with these thousands of other people plus the spectators?
Well, I sometimes am alone in my thoughts, even surrounded by a lot of people. But, you know, the nice thing about then the big city marathon is to hear the crowd and see the environment. I mean, you know, when you're running through the major cities of the world, you know, Paris, London, Berlin, New York, Champaign, Urbana, you see the neighborhoods, you react with the population, you smell what they're cooking, you high-five the kids. It's a very, very wonderful interactive experience. And I must say, you know, so many runners run with earphones now. And I tell them, you know, I'm not going to clap for you if you're wearing earphones, because you're not hearing me. You really got to get into this, you know, get involved with the community.
That is something, I guess, there's a different sense of place as compared to, I assume, if you're running like a mile on a track, most tracks look pretty much alike. But if you're in the city, each of those cities is going to be different.
You know, it is the truth. I used to, when I first started serious running, I was running on the track. I was running 400s and 800s because that's all that was available for women. So, I mean, 400 meters once around the track, 800 meters twice around the track. Honest to God, I felt like a hamster on a wheel in a cage, and I couldn't wait to get out and just run through woods and around lakes, and that's what I decided I would do, and then it was only soon after that I discovered the marathon. But, you know, hats off to people who are good athletes on the track. Their fascination, because my husband was an extremely good track runner, is the drama of the competition. See, and my husband loves the competition. He loves the drama unfolding of the race. He describes it like a stage play, whereas the competition doesn't matter to me. Sure, do I like to win? Do I like to be first? Yeah, but basically what I like to do is run. I don't like to compete so much.
Now, you're going to be here at the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon in Champaign-Urbana. You'll be speaking Friday at 2 p.m. at the Health and Fitness Expo with the marathon. Are you doing any running as well?
Oh, yeah, and I'm also going to be speaking at the pasta dinner. So I think you can kind of go buy a ticket for the pasta dinner and hear me go on and on and on like I'm doing now. But, yes, I'm running also. I am, in fact, right after this, on May the 4th, I'm running a race I organized 30 years ago for the first time in Berlin. It's a women's 10K through the streets of Berlin. It's the 30th anniversary. And so, you know, I run in these races, and I would run in the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon, not the marathon, but Jan and the organizers want me to help with the, you know, starting line radio and finish line prizes and that kind of stuff. So I would run in one of the events, probably not the marathon. I do still run marathons, but I choose them very judiciously, and I am not in shape for a marathon right now.
I'm wondering, of course, if we go back to that Boston Marathon, it's been more than 40 years that you've been running. Marathons are pretty grueling, I think, at any age. How does it work as you get older?
Slower. You get slower. the trick is always to arrive at the starting line uninjured. So one has to, train. I train modestly. I train I train to complete the event now, not train to go fast. And I watch my surfaces very carefully. You know, now at 66, I try not to run on hard roads unless it's a race. And the rest of my training I do on paths, soft dirt paths, which is also nice because I love being a part of nature. But, yes, the desire to get in a race and run is always there for me. And I think it's I'm very, very, very lucky to be running for 53 years. I've only had three injuries. I'm just coming off the third one, which was not my fault. I stepped in a hole running a race and twisted my ankle and inflamed my Achilles. So that can happen to anybody just walking down the street. So I'm coming off of that. I'm a little pudgier than I usually am, but that's okay. It'll come off. And I think it's amazing to be able to still run a marathon. It takes a long time to train, but it's still there.
I'm sure people will get a lot about being able to meet with you and see you speak at the Illinois Marathon this weekend. What do you get out of it going out and visiting and speaking at marathons today?
I think speaking is the thing I like to do the most. You know, the interaction with people is phenomenal. They're so emotional and they're so responsive. I love working with a live audience and then talking to the people individually afterwards. That's really great. I do an awful lot of television commentary, but I find that I'm cutting back on that now. Every year I drop another telecast because it's so ephemeral. You do it and it's lost. You know, nobody cares anymore, and you've got thousands of what you think are pearls of wisdom that kind of are, I don't know, they're hanging in a black hole in space someplace. But when you actually go one-on-one with people, you feel like you can make a difference.
And the extra security details that are going to be out there, they're going to be more careful at the finish line about who can go where. That you don't think that's going to be a serious impediment?
No, it's a shame when the security has to be restricted suddenly like this, and people who would flood into a finish line area and be there cheering, you know, will be restricted. So maybe there will be less of a crowd at the start and the finish because of that. That certainly happened at the New York City Marathon, which was only 7 weeks after 9/11, but certainly it didn't diminish the crowds on the street. It's just that the restricted areas, sometimes that happens. Now that is not so much the case in New York because they've figured out a better security system that works. In time we'll get it in place and it'll be all right. But for right now, it's very sudden. And so my sympathies are with the organizers of this race tomorrow because they might not have had time to put easier systems in place, and it might be a little restrictive there. But, hey, out of the course, everybody's going to be there.
Run the Marathon, Change the World, the official name of your talk. Tell me about the Change the World part.
Well, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of our talk that running is transformational. It is empowering, and it makes you feel fearless. Well, imagine that in societies, especially with women who have never had anything but an impoverished and third-class existence. Let's take, you know, a Kenyan woman or an Ethiopian woman, very, very poor. And she begins to run, and she has this sense of freedom and empowerment. And let's say she gets good because they have natural gifts. She earns prize money in a race. She goes back to her village and helps build a school, or she puts in a well, and she sanitizes water, or she inoculates the kids. So suddenly, you know, the social fabric is beginning to get changed, and she's becoming a very important and revered person. But more importantly, people are seeing that the simple act of putting one foot in front of the other can actively change lives in a very, very positive way. And that's what's happening all over Kenya. these women are making incredible changes. And when those women retire from running, as a couple of them have now, and start to go into politics, it's going to be quite profound. You know, I just came from a race 2 weeks ago in Malaysia, first ever women's only marathon in Malaysia. And I would say a third of the women in the race were Islamic, and they were running in their hijabs, you know, their head wrapped and their arms and legs covered. And they understood that sense of empowerment. And I know that they will understand fitness and fearlessness, and that's going to go a long way, I think, into opening many barriers and doors that we thought we couldn't penetrate culturally and socially. So never underestimate the power of putting one foot in front of the other. It definitely has changed the world. I mean, I could go on and on. I mean, you know, in terms of medical evidence of how running in particular reduces our rate of cardiovascular disease profoundly. It reduces the rate of aging and Alzheimer's. You know, these are studies that are really completely underway now. And so what does that mean? It means maybe at age 85, instead of being bedridden in a nursing home, you're still up living alone in your allowed to be in your own home and having an active life and traveling. I mean, those are things that are very important, and we're just really on the cutting edge of making them happen because running has gone mainstream now.
Well, I've been talking with Catherine Switzer, who is the first woman to enter and complete at the Boston Marathon and a pioneer in bringing women into marathons, winner of its women's division. It was the 1974 New York Marathon, if I'm correct?
That's right. That's the one I won. That's the only big one I won.
And you will be the guest legend, if you're comfortable with that sort of title, at the Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon this weekend, speaking this Friday afternoon at the Health and Fitness Expo. Sold out, but there's a waiting list. If you can get into it at with the time remaining, you can go to illinoismarathon.com. And you'll be out and about during other events as well. Catherine Switzer, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
Jim, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing everybody out in Champaign-Urbana. It's going to be a wonderful event.
And you can find out more about marathon woman Catherine Switzer at CatherineSwitzer.com. And there's more about Jane Brody at her website, janebrody.net. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus.
WILL seeks to be transparent with listeners about its fundraising needs. As such, we've determined that earning $120,000 during our current radio fund drive will put us on track to close out our fiscal year strong on June 30. Your contribution today can directly impact the station's financial success and make it possible for us to eliminate all radio pledge drives until next October. Call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org to lend your support. Thanks.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's Focus on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. And we are likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today. Looking ahead to Monday on Focus, we look at cycling in the city. How are Champaign-Urbana and other central Illinois cities set up for bicyclists? What sort of infrastructure and habits are needed for motorists and cyclists to coexist? Well, on Monday on Focus, I'll be talking with some folks who ponder these questions, including Jeff Yockey, the president of Champaign County Bikes, and transportation planning consultant Cynthia Hall. We'll welcome your comments on the issue that's coming up on Monday's show. Looking ahead to Tuesday's Focus, talking about an issue that we talked about a little bit with Catherine Switzer today on the program, and that's the Boston Marathon bombing. But in this case, we're looking at some of the media coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing and looking at how they handled it and what that tells us about how things are going on now. Were the Boston Marathon bombings an act of terrorism? Does Zokar Sarnaev's ethnicity really matter to the investigation since he is a naturalized American citizen? Our guests on Focus on Tuesday will include Bob Garfield. He's co-host of On the Media, heard every weekend on AM 580, and also Chris Benson, associate professor and associate dean of the University of Illinois College of Media. And that'll be a look at for Tuesday's show next week. Nanotechnology is going to be the topic on Wednesday's show. We'll be talking with Placide Ferreira and Ifran Ahmed about the latest developments on nanotechnology and what that means for us. And from the latest technology, we go to retro technology on Thursday with the resurgence of vinyl. Yes, phonograph records doing better than they have been for a long time. They're doing well across the country. They're doing well in Illinois. And we'll talk with the owner of Exile on Main Street, one of the local record stores in Champaign-Urbana, as well as Chicago Tribune music critic Greg Cott. Those are some of the shows coming up on Focus in the days ahead next week. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580, and there's a replay at 8 p.m. In addition to terrestrial radio, you can hear the show streamed online at will.illinois.edu. Go to that website. You can also listen to past programs, years of past programs, with myself, Craig Cohen, David Inge, and Celeste Quinn. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.